More than 10,000 gun permits were revoked in Illinois last year. When that happens, ISP sends a letter demanding that you turn in your firearm, but most of the time, there's no follow-up. That loophole allowed thousands to keep their weapons, including the gunman in the recent Aurora shooting. Also this hour, the Spurlock Museum in Urbana is featuring stories of the Indian diaspora with objects submitted by local residents. We'll hear what the exhibit says about the many stories of South Asians in Illinois.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, Illinois film critic Reggie Ponder recaps last night's Academy Awards, and the Spurlock Museum in Urbana has a new exhibit showcasing the stories of the Indian diaspora in Illinois. But first, it's been 10 days since a gunman shot and killed five of his co-workers at a manufacturing plant in Aurora. Last week, many of the memorial and funeral services were held for the victims. Six police officers were also injured in this attack. Five had to be hospitalized. Everyone has been released. The shooter, Gary Martin, was killed in a standoff with police. And now lawmakers are also taking a look at how he got his gun. He first received a firearm owner's identification card, commonly known as a FOID card, in 2014, and he got that despite having a felony conviction on his record for aggravated assault in Mississippi. When the Illinois State Police realized their mistake several months later, they revoked his FOID card and sent a letter demanding he surrender his gun, but nothing happened after that. And it turns out this happens a lot. ISP said late last week more than 10,000 FOID cards were revoked last year, but nearly 75% of those orders were ignored. State Senator Julie Morrison is a Democrat who's been trying to close this loophole. She represents Illinois' 29th Senate District, which includes parts of Chicago's north and northwest suburbs, including Deerfield, Lake Forest, and Highland Park. Welcome to the 21st, Senator Morrison.
Thanks for having me this morning.
So you actually introduced a bill regarding this last session, and I wonder, were you worried that something like the Aurora shooting would happen?
When you look at the process that we have in place now for removing both FOID cards and firearms from someone who is no longer entitled to have those, the process itself has so many gaps and is riddled with mistakes. So that's one of the reasons I was working on this last spring and am dedicated to getting something done this year. There's no excuse for people who are gun owners to have their FOID card removed and then still be able to have a gun.
So let's talk about exactly how this worked and what happened in this specific instance. I wonder if you could first walk us through exactly how Gary Martin's felony conviction fell through the cracks when he first applied for a FOID card. People might wonder how something like that doesn't come up when someone's applying for a gun license in Illinois.
Well, in this instance, when he applied for a FOID card, the background check simply didn't go out of state. It's only when he applied for his concealed carry license and submitted fingerprints that there was then access to the FBI database, which showed, oh my gosh, this happened in Mississippi. This man should not be carrying a firearm. So the background check was not as complete or thorough as it could have been because it did not have the ability to go into that FBI database.
And so if someone lies on their FOID card application like he did, this was a way he was able to get away with this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so right now, what happens when ISP, the Illinois State Police, revokes a FOID card? What exactly is supposed to happen?
A letter is sent to the last address that they are aware of the person was living at, and it's almost an honor system. You have lost your FOID card. You must surrender it, and you must surrender your firearms. And then the state police also notify local law enforcement. Unfortunately, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, 10,000 revocations a year all over the state of Illinois. It puts a tremendous burden on local law enforcement to go door to door and collect both cards and or firearms, especially since we're not even sure you could have a FOID card but not own a gun. They're not registered. There's no record of who has what. So one of the things we have absolutely got to do is sit down, and I've begun conversations with different law enforcement folks. How are we going to do this in a uniform way across the state?
Because obviously it seems like putting the responsibility on Illinois State Police and asking ISP, for example, to directly confiscate guns from people who've had their licenses revoked could also be a pretty dangerous situation.
It's dangerous for whomever, whether it is a local law enforcement, whether it's a sheriff, whether it's the state police, to go to a home where someone is going to be asked to surrender his firearm. They don't know what they're walking into. They also probably will walk into a home where firearms are probably not going to be sitting on the kitchen counter for law enforcement just to pick up and walk out the door with. So the concerns of search and seizure, of being able to go in with multiple officers, how many detectives do we need? Do we need a dog? There are so many facets to this, and yet we can't any longer just look the other way and say this is too hard for us to do. Sheriff Dart in Cook County has a team of officers who have been trained and especially work on just this type of thing, and they have been able to recover several guns that way.
And so that's what he said this on Friday, right, that every police department should create a unit designed to take firearms away from people who will not surrender them voluntarily. Is that something you think that every police department should try to do from a resource standpoint?
You know, unfortunately, a lot of our police departments are not resourced, don't have enough manpower or the training and or equipment to necessarily go to a door and have a violent confrontation. And that can happen too often. I'm going to be asking law enforcement, I'm going to be developing a task force this year for these folks, the people that we trust with the enforcement, to sit down and talk through the best way to get this done and where do we need to put our resources so that we can do this. In the meantime, we can do other things. We can have a more thorough background. I think we should look at the implications of having a fingerprint for a FOID card. I think that we should look at enhancing penalties for those people who simply ignore that revocation letter, who do nothing to conform with what is being required. Right now, there's no teeth in the law, and we need to put some teeth in it. There need to be penalties that actually get the attention of the offender.
And I think you mentioned something. I think people might not realize that you can apply for a FOID card, you can apply for a gun permit, and you don't have to be fingerprinted.
That's right.
Do you think that should be part of the process?
I actually do. That's going to be a heavy lift. The gun lobby in the state of Illinois has resisted that. And yet, I think the good actors, the people who have nothing to fear, nothing to hide, should be more than happy to go along with that change. Would actually make the FOID card more transparent, but also move the process along quicker. The state police right now does not have probably adequate administrative support to process the thousands and thousands of applications they get every year for FOID cards, for concealed carry licenses, and also for the revocations. This would make things move much more quickly and more efficiently for everybody concerned.
Can I ask, you mentioned the gun lobby, and I want to come back to that in a minute, but I just want to ask, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that you proposed some changes last session. You introduced them again last month. Specifically, what kind of changes are you hoping to make this year?
So one of the things that I'm hoping to do is when your firearms, if you lose your firearms and your FOID card, you now have the ability to transfer those to someone else to hold for you. They can go to law enforcement, or they can go to another person that you know that has a FOID card. You're supposed to complete a disposition form, and that is sent then to law enforcement. Last April, there was a terrible shooting in Tennessee where a father who was holding his son's weapons decided just to give them back. The son went into the Waffle House in Tennessee, so I kind of refer to this as the Waffle House bill, and shot people dead. The person who is responsible for those guns also must bear the responsibility of the actions if he returns those guns prematurely to the original owner. That's one of the important things that we need to do.
You mentioned the gun lobby, and I just wanted to end by asking you about that. Senator Morrison, you are from the Chicago area. Chicago has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. So I'm thinking in particular with Highland Park, your constituency, this is a very popular political decision for you to lobby for this. But I wonder what you're saying to colleagues in districts outside of Chicago where you might run into disagreements with people who support, who the gun lobby supports, gun rights organizations like the Illinois Rifle Association or the NRA. What would you say to those lawmakers who work closely with those organizations to get some movement on this issue?
So, Niala, I was born and raised in central Illinois, in Cass County. So I grew up in a different culture in terms of how people had guns, used guns, and the whole mind frame around gun violence. I would say to all my colleagues, and I do, that it's time for us to be responsible about gun ownership. And nobody wants violence in their community. Nobody wants to see firearms misused. Most gun owners are responsible people. However, we've gotten to the point in 2019 where we need to step back, not be fearful of some of the propaganda that is coming out of the gun lobby, and be responsible citizens towards one another across the whole state.
That's State Senator Julie Morrison, as she's mentioned, originally from Central Illinois, represents Illinois' 29th district now. Senator, thank you for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about ISP, Illinois State Police, revoking nearly 10,000 gun permits last year. They're also called FOID cards, as you've been hearing. There's no follow-up beyond the letter you'd get demanding that you turn in your gun. And this has been an issue for years. WBEZ Chicago first reported on this back in 2013. They're taking a look at it again in the wake of the Aurora shooting. Patrick Smith is WBEZ Chicago's criminal justice reporter. He's with us now from their studios. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could just respond immediately to what Senator Morrison just said there in terms of what stood out to you the most about what she's trying to create change for.
Well, I think what stood out is just how many different parts of this issue there are to be addressed. You know, the reason that this is not an easy thing to address is because there's so many facets. There's not just follow-up on the FOID cards, which, as you pointed out, you know, trying to go get weapons is a dangerous and difficult task. There's also how we do background checks in the first place. There's the question of when you're surrendering those weapons, are you turning them over to someone who's really safe and responsible? And what happens if those guns end up back with the wrong person or a person who we've determined shouldn't be there? So I think just in her answers, you heard how many different parts of this there are to attack and how many different parts of it lawmakers are looking at right now.
And so I think because this is such a complicated thing, would you say politically that's why there haven't really been changes to the system in Illinois?
I mean, that sounds right. I think my knowledge of what happened in 2016, there was a bill introduced by Representative Kathleen Willis and Representative Greg Harris, among others, that looked specifically at that issue of revoked FOIDs and what happens to the guns of people who have their gun permits revoked. And my understanding at the time was that one of the issues was resources, that if you're going to make local departments do this, you're putting a lot of pressure on them. You're adding a lot to their plate without any additional funding, you know, and if you're going to have the state police do it, that's going to take a lot more money, too. So I think one part of it is you're right. There's a lot of different elements, and that could be difficult politically. The other thing is just if you're going to ask police to do more, you've got to find a way to pay for that and support them in doing that.
What has ISP told you about this, especially this in the past week or two? They were put out a pretty extensive statement last week about the process of what happened in the Aurora incident.
Yeah, ISP has put out a lot of information about what happened in the Aurora incident and what happens or really doesn't happen when gun permits or FOID cards are revoked. You know, as you mentioned, the letter goes out and then that's really it. And Director Kelly, Acting Director Brendan Kelly, said in a statement that the only way to honor the dead in Aurora was to be honest about the system and the failings. I will say I've been disappointed. Director Kelly has so far denied any interview requests on this. And I know he's new, but that's something that we found in 2013, too, when WBEZ reported on this, was that the director of the state police at the time wouldn't do an interview on this particular issue. So I haven't gotten much more information than what they've put out to everybody about how this process works and where this process is failing.
We have to take a break. When we come back from that break, we'll pick up this conversation with Patrick Smith. Patrick, I just want to ask you a little bit about Senator Morrison's proposals, what other lawmakers are saying, what the likelihood there is of any action changing on this in this upcoming legislative session. We're talking to Patrick Smith from WBEZ Chicago, and you're listening to The 21st. Stay close. Just after the short break, we'll pick up this conversation with Patrick.
Support for WILL comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, opening its spring season with new art exhibitions at the CAM Opening Night Celebration, Thursday, February 28th, starting at 6 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Illinois State Police revoking nearly 10,000 gun permits last year. That's a FOID card. And we're talking about what happens when they revoke a permit. And this particularly incident is relevant now because of the Aurora shooting that happened 2 weeks ago. That shooter, Gary Martin, had a FOID card that had been revoked and still had a gun. Patrick Smith is with us from WBEZ Chicago. This is an issue WBEZ Chicago has been reporting on for some time. Patrick, as I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you all first reported on this back in 2013. Has anything changed with the system since WBEZ first reported on this 6 years ago, these loopholes in the system?
There does not seem to be any change. You know, that was reported actually by WBEZ reporter Al Keefe back in 2013. Since he did that story, which was about something that officials called a, quote, outrageously insane loophole in the law, he left BEZ, came back to BEZ as an editor. He's had a lot of changes in his life, but there does not seem to have been any changes in the policy or the way things are handled at the state police or with local departments when it comes to how it's handled when people have FOID cards revoked.
And then remind us again, and I think Senator Morrison didn't tell us specifically, what are the legal consequences if you get that letter from ISP saying you have to, your gun permit has been revoked? What are the legal consequences right now to ignoring that?
Well, so it is a crime. I can't say I have the penalty in front of me. It is a crime in Illinois to not respond to that, to not turn over your firearms. You know, you get that letter, you have to either go surrender your weapons and your FOID card to a local police department, or you have to show that you've given it to another legal gun owner. If you don't do that, you're breaking the law. You can be arrested and prosecuted for that. However, state police numbers show that last year, I think they arrested 10 people for that crime, even though we know that thousands and thousands of people just didn't respond to those letters. So thousands and thousands of people broke the law. We know their address, or at least their last known address. However, you know, 10 people were arrested for committing that crime.
And as you talk up to different groups about this, not just, I want to ask what the Illinois State Rifle Association has told you. I want to just go back to Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart. On Friday, he said every police department should create a unit designed to take firearms away from people who won't surrender them voluntarily. How much resources has Cook County been able to put into this? Because, again, as you said, this is a question of resources and training on behalf of police departments all across the state.
Yeah, well, I know that Sheriff Dart created that task force in 2013, that they have dedicated officers for it. He's acknowledged in interviews with me and in his announcement on Friday that this takes additional resources. His suggestion was that we fund those additional resources, what we need from local departments, by increasing the cost of a FOID or gun permit application in Illinois. That's something that State Rep. Kathleen Willis also put out there as a possible way to fund these changes, is to increase the cost of a FOID card. Right now, it's $10 to apply for a FOID card, and it's good for 10 years, so $1 a year. Dart proposed increasing it to $15 to apply. Representative Willis, she was just sort of floating it out there as a possibility. She didn't have specific numbers on how much she would want to increase that to pay for the increase in law enforcement resources.
So say it was an increase of $5, so a FOID card costs $15 for 10 years. What has the Illinois State Rifle Association said about that?
Well, so the Illinois State Rifle Association, I talked to their director, Richard Pearson, last week, and he said he absolutely agrees that this issue of revoked FOID cards and nothing happening is an issue. It's an important issue. He said he was willing to work with lawmakers on it. However, he brought up the issue of resources, and when I talked about that idea, you know, hey, people are considering increasing the FOID card, he said they would absolutely be against that, they fought over this in court, and they would go to court again to try to stop an increase. He said that this is a constitutional right and that increasing the fee would be a tax on a constitutional right. So he said, yeah, we think there's a problem here. He didn't give prescriptions for the solution, but he did say the solution cannot include, in his mind, an increase to the cost of FOID cards.
So all that said, are you getting a sense that this problem could actually be addressed in the coming months when we think about all of these different groups? Patrick, as you're thinking about your conversations with law enforcement, with gun rights advocates, as well as with lawmakers?
I am getting that sense. You know, I talked to a couple of representatives last week who said that they are working on this. Representative Willis said she expected to introduce legislation within the month. And, you know, the governor's office has not been committal, but they have said that they're working on this with lawmakers. So, yeah, I get the sense that something will be done. I don't know, you know, what will happen once it's introduced. But, yes, I've heard that there is movement on this. They expect to introduce legislation.
Patrick Sprith reports on criminal justice for WBEZ Chicago. As we said, he's been reporting on this issue. We'll tweet out Patrick's stories on this if you're interested in learning more. Patrick, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
There's nearly a quarter of a million South Asian Americans in Illinois, making the group the biggest and fastest growing group of Asian Americans in the state. Some families have been here for more than a century and actually have deep roots in Illinois. Others got here more recently. Perhaps they're students whose families live in India right now. And over the next few weeks, the Spurlock Museum is showcasing just a few of these stories, by the way, including my family's, of Indians and the diaspora, in an exhibit called From the Subcontinent to the Prairie, Stories of Immigration and Identity. It's on display until May 19th in Urbana and is connected to a community-wide reading program between the U of I and libraries in both Champaign and Urbana. To focus on a best-selling book about growing up as an immigrant in America, it's called The Namesake by Jhumpa Lahiri. Joining me now is the exhibit's guest community curator, Koeli Goel. She completed her PhD at the U of I and runs a foundation for women's rights in India called the Daratri Ecosphere. Beth Watkins is also with us. She's the Spurlock Museum's education and publications coordinator. Koeli, Beth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
I wondered if we could start, Koeli, when we think of Asian Americans, I think oftentimes people tend to think of East Asians, of people who are maybe Chinese or Korean or Japanese. But as I mentioned, here in Illinois, our population is a little bit different.
Yes, and if you look at the university, there is a large number of Indian faculty members as well as students. So it makes meaning the last fall semester, the registration of international students was highest among Asians, and the second highest after East Asia, like China, was India. And so with community members here. But then we are quite silent as a model minority. So people don't get to know so much about us.
And so, Beth, I wonder how much of that, what Coeli's saying, was part of the reason for the Spurlock Museum choosing a book about the South Asian diaspora for this community-wide reading project?
Absolutely. We knew the namesake would resonate with people in our town, and not just people from South Asia, but, you know, anyone who's moved from one home to another. And we knew it would give us an opportunity to collaborate with a lot of community members, both on campus and in Champaign and Urbana locally.
And so this is, this Spurlock project is called The Big Read. And the whole community, can you tell us just a little bit about how this program is supposed to work? So the whole community, it's sort of like a book club for an entire community?
That's right. Yeah, it's over 35 events, including 10 book discussions in a course of about 6 weeks with Spurlock Museum, the International and Area Studies Library at the University, Champaign Public Library, the Urbana Free Library, the Art Theater, all sorts of other organizations in town, all focusing on the namesake.
And can you tell us a little bit about Namesake, the book?
I can. It is the story of two Indians from Calcutta who immigrate to the United States in the 1960s, and their children are born and bred in Massachusetts. And it's the story of these individuals as individual people, but also as a family, and how they navigate loss and thinking of home and thinking of identity.
Coeli, there's the Big Read, and then there's a community exhibit at Spurlock. What's the connection between the namesake and this exhibit?
So Jhumpa Lahiri's namesake was taken as the organizing principle in the exhibit called The Subcontinent to the Prairie. And almost close to 50 some families contributed, and they are still adding. And there are family heirlooms. There are like yours, and then there are also very new items of children being trained in traditional Indian arts, and the memorabilia from them and those families also. There is some heritage items, which is the framed Dakai sari, which has been inherited and passed down in my family, which is also showing, as well as, you know, faculty members who got married in their saris. So there is this little wedding exhibition, because wedding is a big theme in the namesake. So we decided to pull in the public with sort of wedding, colorful Bengali wedding exhibit and jewelry and colorful saris and all the garments.
Before we get into a little bit more of the exhibition, I'm just curious what when you read the namesake and what you like about the book.
It reflected very closely the experience of my children. And I have four, and two of them were born in India but grew up here, and one of them is called Gogol. So Gogol is a very common name, but all four of them went through, in different degrees, the identity crisis that Gogol, or Nikhil as he changes his name, went through in the namesake. So that is a very important focus of what immigrant families deal with every day. There's sort of a division, cleaving the parents from the children, and focusing on the namesake brought that out into the open and generated conversations across campus. And I'm very glad about that.
And Beth, it was also important for you guys, as you said, not to include just the campus, but the community in terms of having community partners.
Yeah, we really wanted to have the NEA Big Read program connect the whole town as much as we possibly could. And, you know, being a university unit, we're well accustomed to collaborating with other campus units, but it's a little harder to sometimes get off of campus and really do meaningful work together. And the NEA program really made that possible, because we're planning together, we're executing programs together, and just linking people and inviting people to all of those different physical spaces as well.
And I wanted to ask you about that as well. If you all worked with several partners on this, the Art Theater in Champaign, the Champaign and Urbana Public Library Systems. I wonder, as we're thinking about people listening in other communities throughout Illinois, how important it was for you all, the Spurlock Museum, to be partnering with other smaller groups throughout the community to then collaborate on getting NEA funding for this?
It was extremely important because when we all work together, and most of these projects are things we would be doing more or less anyway, but we can do them together and we can plan something that is more meaningful for the whole community. And it's actually not that hard to put something like this together if you just meet ahead of time and really think about, you know, be deliberate in what you're planning to do.
Is this the first time the Spurlock has gotten an NEA grant?
This is actually the first time the U of I at Urbana-Champaign has gotten an NEA Big Read grant. I've seen that U of I Springfield has done it before, but this is the first time for the Urbana campus to be part of this community reading program.
Coeli, how did you get involved in the project then?
I think Beth Watkins and Elizabeth did a great job of reaching out to me. And since part of my in my PhD, part of my specialization is cultural studies, and I've written a couple of books on South Asian culture. I think that triggered what would be their very eager eagerness to include me in the exhibit.
As the guest curator.
Yes.
And then what other partners did you reach out to throughout the community to try to bring objects to this exhibit? You mentioned a couple university people, but what about within the community?
So as I am a community organizer here, so as a part of the Hindu Temple and Cultural Society, as part of the U of IY, as part of the East Central Illinois Bengali Association, I'm the vice president. I had access to quite a few community members, and that was one of the key points why this came together so well and almost what seemed seamlessly, and many members came forward with their family heirlooms. So I actually entered through the gateway of the organizations I'm part of and also my campus connections.
So my family, I was asked to take part in this exhibit. And I think some of our listeners know that my family is Indian by way of Trinidad. So it would be my great-great-grandparents that left India and came to Trinidad. And then my parents moved to the U.S. So I am also first generation. But when I was asking my parents about this, we had a long discussion. It was actually really interesting because we went back into our family history and we had these two brass ceremonial vases that came actually from both sides, from my mom's and my dad's family that we lent for this exhibit. I wonder, when we think about the diaspora, it's so big. If you think about whether it's my family and being five generations removed from India, your family, Coeli, you were born in India. How did you all, it's a huge population that represents lots of different stories. What did you all try to focus on for this exhibit?
So as soon as you say the word Indian culture, it brings all these various and very diverse groups together. And just like I arrived straight from India, and so did my husband, but he spent 40 years here. So the other groups, there was one lady who was not born in India. She was born in Africa, but she retained her culture. And she was the one who would take her daughters all the way to Indianapolis to be trained in Bharatanatyam. And we actually show the pictures of their dancing anklets in the exhibition. Then there are other members of the faculty who have initiated different very ancient rituals which were in India and which we didn't know, the recent arrivals. But they have held on to that from the time when they arrived here, probably in the 1960s. And we put the exhibit there in a picture called the Satabhishekam. So there are various groups from various ages, and it just brings together the whole area by that one term, Indian culture and Indian art.
Right. And as you say that, I'm thinking about the water vessels that that my family has. And that's also something that they retained from generations removed. I wanted to just end by asking one last question. It's always tough. I wonder how you make sure people don't leave with maybe an exoticized idea of South Asia, because I think that sometimes can happen.
I think by having stories with names actually attached to them, that these are people that, you know, live down the street from you, that you see at the grocery store, that really helps reinforce that these are people in Champaign-Urbana who come from all sorts of different places with very differing paths to get here. But I think Coeli has also done a wonderful job of finding artifacts that reflect themes in the novel. So we'll be familiar a little bit to people as part of an American story as well as part of an Indian story.
And so, as I mentioned, the Big Read events are happening over central Illinois, mostly all in Champaign-Urbana over the next month or so. I'm actually moderating an event this evening at the Asian American Cultural Center on the U of I campus about immigration and cultural identity when it comes to Indian American communities. I want to thank Bette Watkins with Spurlock and Coeli Goel, the guest community curator of this exhibit. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What does it mean to provide more access in the academic publishing world, and how does that affect what we all read? Well, the Mellon Foundation recently awarded $1.2 million to help bring more diversity to academic publishing. The money will go towards fellowships at five different presses, including Northwestern University Press and the University of Chicago Press. Joining me on the line now is Parnisha Jones. She's a sales and community outreach manager and the poetry editor for Northwestern University Press. Parnisha, thanks for joining us. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you for having me. It's a real great pleasure to talk about this. Thank you.
And you're welcome. Before we get into this grant specifically, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about Northwestern University Press, because I think when people say university press, people might assume that we're talking strictly about nonfiction or academic works.
Sure. Northwestern University Press, I always like to say that Northwestern University Press is kind of the wild child of academic publishers, because our core focus is in the humanities, and so much of what we publish deals with contemporary fiction and poetry. We do obviously publish academic titles in philosophy, in theater, translated works, and so we kind of cover a broad range of areas in the humanities. We were founded in 1893, and we publish about 65 to 70 titles new titles a year, and so we do a range of things, whether it's creative or whether it's more scholarly, and it's a great place to be.
And how do you think academic publishing can have a ripple effect on all kinds of literature that's published then?
You know, academic publishing, I think that, you know, in terms of academic publishers, we're kind of the vessel for the idea of great thinkers of the world. I think that translates into how the more artistic world is influenced by, I think, the scholarly world, the great philosophers, the great thinkers of the world. And so much of what we do, especially at Northwestern, is that we do focus on things like arts and literature. And so I think there's more conversations and there's broader meanings about what scholarly actually means. And so we, I think, are in charge of spearheading, putting those conversations into a wider medium and letting them have more global voices.
And for people who aren't in academia, they might not make the connection between publishing and career advancement. And I wanted to just ask you about that. My dad's actually a retired university professor. I always remember him saying when I was a kid, publish or perish. Is that still true?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I do think, because people want, I think it's part of, it's important because people take that as a part of you being versed in the world. I mean, I think publishing is very key to how knowledge is disseminated throughout the world. And so it still is something, I like what your dad says, publish or perish, because, I mean, if you're going to be an academic thinker, if you're going to be in charge of sharing knowledge within classrooms and students and scholars, publishing is a great part of that. Publishing your knowledge, publishing your beliefs and the different places that you've been in the world, I think, is absolutely key. So there is the direct connection between the academic world and all of our thinkers that we have teaching our future.
And so I wonder about the specifics of this grant, how you think this fellowship might change access or broaden access to the academic publishing world.
Sure. I mean, you know, one of the things that is happening is that we're getting more and more in this idea of what the conversations of what inclusion, what diversity look like. And I think what this grant allows is for those conversations to happen at the foundation level of publishing. We are really, really grateful to be able to partner with our sister presses like the University of Washington Press, MIT, Cornell, Ohio State, and the University of Chicago to offer this fellowship, and which, you know, the Mellon Foundation has been so gracious to grant us, is that the people get to come in and be apprentice in the acquisitions department. And that's really where a book begins in publishing, is in the acquisitions department. And so to have people who are coming in and a more diverse background coming in to help us think about our vision in terms of what we want to publish, in terms of the voices that we want to bring in from the ground level, is not only key for, you know, the Mellon Fellows that will be coming in, but it's key for us as publishers to learn about different parts of the world and what people want to read.
And so I think the word diversity can mean a lot of different things to,
sure,
to depends on who you're talking to. And I wonder,
exactly,
for you, what does more diversity in academic publishing, when we're thinking particularly about these acquisitions departments that are participating, what does that look like?
I mean, diversity is an ocean word. As you said, it is, depending on who you ask, it can mean something very different. And it's one of the words that actually I grow tired of hearing constantly. I think that, you know, in so many different ways and conversations, that word diversity, inclusion, global have somewhat got diluted about how people are looking at that. And so I feel that at this time, we're in a moment where people are absolutely curious about each other. And so I like the word curious more than I like the word diversity. And I feel that if you actually are a person who is wanting to step outside of the Webster's definition of the word diversity, and you're just actually curious about the world, you're curious about human beings and curious about humanity and how other people live and the whole universal effects of our stories, I think that that's kind of how we're trying to approach the way that we look at diversity, that it's not necessarily one defined definition, that it's actually just being curious about people and about the world.
And I wonder if you think that Northwestern, when you mentioned that Northwestern University Press started more than a century ago, how much you think that the catalog reflects that curiosity or that those plurality of voices?
I think that it's always had a curiosity about the world. I mean, one of the things that Northwestern University Press is famous for is translations. And so I always think that it's always been curious, but it's been a curious that I don't think has always reflected the entire world. And to be honest, you know, and to be fair, it's very difficult to do that. You know, you can only publish so many books. But I think what has happened is that we're realizing that more stories need to be told from other parts of the world that didn't necessarily get the chance. I mean, as a Black editor and one of the few Black editors in poetry and in the creative writing world, one of the things that's been a commitment for me is publishing the voices of Black women poets, because I feel that publishing wasn't necessarily built for Black women poets or Black women writers. And so what Northwestern is being committed to now is understanding that there are so many different parts of the world that didn't get a chance to tell their stories or didn't get to be part of the history books and the record books in an accurate way. And so what has happened now is that we're trying to retrace those parts of the world and trying to bring those stories to the forefront.
That's Parnesha Jones, a sales and community outreach manager, as well as poetry editor of Northwestern University Press. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me. You take care.
You probably recognize that. It's Lady Gaga, who was singing with Bradley Cooper from last night's Oscars, a song called Shallow, which won the award for Best Original Song. And if you didn't tune into what is a Super Bowl for movie fans, don't worry. We've got Reggie Ponder here to play Monday Morning Quarterback. He's the Real Critic. Hey, Reggie, welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, how are you?
I have to say I have a lot of feelings about last night's Oscar ceremony, but I want to hear what you think. And before we get into who won and who lost, There was a lot of talk about how this year the Oscars wouldn't have a host. I wonder what you thought, how that went.
So I actually think it went well. Basically what they did is that they took a lot of people to do the same thing that a host would have done. So they had some skits, they had some jokes, all that type of stuff, but they just let a lot of people do it. I think that it actually ended up working, and that actually the Oscar might have been a big winner in that regard. One of the reasons that people didn't want to take the job is that it takes a lot to prepare to be the Oscar host. You don't get paid a lot to be an Oscar host.
And then everybody and just the tells you what a terrible job you did.
And the criticism is really tough. So in this case, you just have your one shot when you're doing your little skit and you're presenting that one or two awards to be criticized, and you can't mess up the whole show. So there's not going to be a lot out there that says, oh, man, that person was just the worst. The show was terrible because of the host. So I think they won out here. I think it actually worked for them.
Well, another big challenge the Oscars have faced is, I'm thinking of a couple of years ago, the hashtag of Oscars So White, and the Academy has been pledging to do better. How do you think the Academy did this year?
Well, they were determined, in fact, to say, you're not going to say Oscars So White here, because if you looked just at the presenters, the diversity was very strong and on Front Street there. So they did a really great job there to say, you're not going to do that. Secondly, when you just look at the films that were nominated for Best Picture, you have Black Panther, Black Klansman, Green Book, Bohemian Rhapsody, and The Favorite with diversity in different areas. So that's five of the films right off the top. So I think that the Oscars did pretty well as it relates to making sure that they were more inclusive and had more diversity. When we start to talk about awards, and I know we will, I think about 30% of the awards went to women. And when I say 30%, there's multiple people received many of the awards. So I tried to do all the counting, and I think about 30% of those awards went to women. So I think they did pretty well overall.
Now let's talk about, you mentioned Green Book, the winner for Best Picture. I know Spike Lee was one of the many people in the audience who was not happy with that. What's your take on this?
So I'm in agreement with Spike Lee. So I think we might have talked about this before. When I went to see the movie Green Book, I left saying, man, that was good. I really enjoyed it and really liked it because I didn't have any of the backstory. I didn't know that they did not contact Don Shirley's family. And I didn't know that Don Shirley's family was upset about a number of things, and three things that I'll mention real quick. One, the fried chicken scene, they said that just never happened, that Don Shirley knew what fried chicken was. Number two, the fact that he was estranged from his family. His brother was like, that's absolutely a falsity. And then there was number three, that he didn't know African-American popular music was also not correct. So that that instead of embellishing, that there were actually lies in the movie. So
about the main black character.
About the main black character. So that's problematic. And I know that Mahershala Ali actually called the cousin and the brother, and said, look, I'm sorry if I did anything that offended you guys. I worked with the material that I had, and if I had known there were family to consult to make sure that I can do better nuanced acting and make sure that I could have filled in the character better, I would have done that. And he apologized to him in a very, very respectful way.
There was no mention of that yesterday evening, I will say, as they were all collecting their awards for the Green Book. I wonder, Reggie, if you think that it's not an Oscars if there isn't a controversy.
Yeah, because these are popular awards as opposed to there's some real formula to come about and say, hey, this is the absolute best movie. Because it's really subjective, that you're always going to have some kind of controversy. But these kind of controversies, are unacceptable. And I think you were upset because do your research. Come on, guys. Do your research. And when you have a historical figure you need to really do your research, and especially with a historical figure that's lesser known. Because
well, and as I would say, as I point out, as we've had historians on the show that have also said it was historically inaccurate about Illinois. I will just throw that one out there, too.
Right. There you go. So I'm like you. I was not happy with that. And I heard Spike walked out, and I also saw Spike said that the referee made a bad call. So I'm not happy that Green Book won that.
All right. There's lots to be talked about still. I'm sure lots of people will continue to have these conversations, especially on social media. Reggie Ponder, a Chicago-based Real Critic. Thanks for being with us, Reggie. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks again.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, I wonder, have you been getting a lot of robocalls lately? Maybe they've been about debt or someone pretending to be the IRS. I'm getting a lot of calls in Mandarin. We're going to be talking about this tomorrow. We'd love to hear about what robocalls you get and how you deal with them. You can send us an email at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. We promise we will not give your information to anyone. It is safe with us. You can always find more information for past shows at 21stshow.org. Thanks for the Band Public Access. Thanks to the Band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.